Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the line is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. I believe that winter has arrived.
Winter has arrived, and
in Iowa.
With winter, with the season, it is nutcracker season.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about our author and our book today, Caroline.
Well, the book is The Nutcracker Chronicles, and the author is Janine Kovac, and she enjoyed a 12-year career as a professional ballet dancer in Iceland, Italy, San Francisco, and her hometown of El Paso, Texas. Outside of the ballet world, her distinctions include UC Berkeley's Glusko Award for Distinguished Research in Cognitive Science, and Elizabeth George Foundation Fellowship from Hedgebrook, and the Calderwood Fellowship for Journalism for McDowell. And she's also written some books. I mean, she's very accomplished, and you're going to really enjoy this interview, I'm sure.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Janine.
Thank you for having me, Monica and Caroline.
So the Nutcracker Chronicles focuses on your life as a dancer and also on the Nutcracker in particular. Why did you center this memoir around the Nutcracker?
I started because I just had so many Nutcracker anecdotes, just fun things that happened backstage or on stage, or just the life of a dancer that centered around dancing Nutcracker after Nutcracker. That makes you kind of feel like you're in Nietzsche's eternal return, that this life that happens over and over in the context of these 2 hours, that is the ballet. And then as I started writing, because I thought that would be kind of cute to have a story on stage that was going on, the battle, the party scene, and then tell you what was happening backstage. But as I started to do that, I realized that it needed a through line. So if I'm going to follow the through line is Clara's journey. Which, if you know the Nutcracker, a little girl named Clara gets a Nutcracker for Christmas. Her brother Fritz breaks it. And then magic happens. We're not quite sure why, but it's apparently a magic Nutcracker. She comes to the aid of this Nutcracker when the mice and the soldiers fight. And then she gets to go to a fairyland where she sits around and watches other people dance. And then at the end, she goes home. Which is kind of like a life... of a dancer. You dance, you have your victory lap, and then it's over and you're still alive and very much wanting to dance, but you go to performances, or in my case, I was a teacher and the wife of a dancer. So that's kind of how the story evolved. The other thing that happens in the Nutcracker is that it's one of the only full-length romantic ballets, so from the 19th century, where there's no real star. There's the Sugar Plum Fairy, but she only dances for about 7 minutes. And there's Clara, but as I said, she doesn't do a lot in the second act, certainly not to move the story forward. And so you can be involved in the Nutcracker and have a prominent role, even if you're only on stage for 90 seconds. The audience will remember the Russian variation, even though it's only a minute and a half. So I felt like that's very much how we are in our lives, where we feel like we're the star of our lives and we contribute to a bigger picture, even though it might seem like just a moment in the spotlight.
So there's a lot of parts in the Nutcracker. A lot
right.
of, I mean, if every dancer only danced one role, how many would it take?
Well, that's the other amazing thing about the Nutcracker. And I'm often asked, and people often wonder, why do we do the Nutcracker every year? It's a lifeblood for companies and ballet studios. And part of that is because it's such a flexible storyline and your cast can be, you can have little 4-year-old bunnies, you can have an 80-year-old grandmother in the party scene, you can have a snow that has 16 flowers or 6 flowers. So it can accommodate a lot of ranges of age, of ability, and so it's very welcoming in that way. So that's, yeah, there's, so that, to answer your question, you could accommodate 100 dancers and you might be able to do it slimmed down to 30.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Oh boy. I didn't realize that. That's interesting. That's really interesting. You know, yeah. It really is.
Right. And then, and that gives choreographers a lot to work with because they can adapt this storyline and this music that is so recognizable to what they have, on hand.
So for someone who's not really familiar with the world of ballet, you know, I would have had the expectation that these classical ballets had set choreography, that everybody does the same choreography, but that isn't necessarily the case.
Well, that's a really good question. In fact, ballets such as Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty are set, are pretty much the same choreography that was set in 1890, whatever. But in the case with the Nutcracker, the Russian choreographer at the time got sick. There were a lot of things that happened behind the scenes in the first Nutcracker. That means that we don't really have that choreography that hasn't been handed down. And part of that was because a lot of people didn't like the first Nutcracker. They didn't like the idea that Clara was a main character and a little, and played by a little girl, danced by a little girl. There are many things that audiences did not like about the Nutcracker, and so that choreography wasn't handed down from dancer to dancer to dancer.
Interesting. Now, one of your first big roles in the Nutcracker was Fritz, the brother.
Right, the brother who breaks the Nutcracker. That was my signature role for many years.
How old were you when you started dancing that role?
I was about 12. And my fellow partygoers, we were all 12 years old. So we were all the age of what those dancers were in that role.
So I got to say, reading through your memoir and your childhood as wanting to be a ballerina, it didn't make it sound very appealing. It sounded pretty miserable most of the time, to be honest. Nobody treated you very nicely.
Some people did.
Well,
treat you very nicely.
It's very competitive. I mean, really competitive. And of course, I suppose that's true of any kind of thing, like any dancing thing. You've just really got to be.
Or sports, or a lot of other artistic endeavors too are very competitive. So I mean, you
why
as
did
a
I,
dan- yeah. Why did you
why,
keep wanting
why
to
do
it? Because your parents
question.
Weren't pushing you; they were supporting you, but they weren't pushing
right.
you.
That's right.
Yeah.
If at any moment I said, "Okay, I've had enough," my mother would say, "Oh, thank God." Well, first of all, there's a magic that you feel. I think when you're drawn to an art, whether it is writing or dancing or painting or whatever that is, there's something inside you that is fulfilled by doing that thing. And for me, that was dance. And there's a lot of gratification in that journey. There's something I can't do, but I keep at it every day, and eventually I can do it. And even though it's competitive in the sense that there are lots of people who want to do it and not a lot of spots available for them. But it's not competitive in the sense that each individual is their own shining diamond. No, you are, I'm not competing with somebody else because there's nobody else who looks like me now or dances like me or has the same work ethic that manifests in the same way that I am. So when you keep at it, you find your tribe, the director that is looking for this collection of jewels, so to speak. And you're fed by being in community with other dancers who, again, aren't really competing with you in the same way because you're not all the same, even if you're trying to dance the same steps. And it's your family. And then again, there's nothing like going on stage and dancing a role, even if it's a small role.
And there were, you know, you had some successes along the way that maybe kept you going when you had the disappointments, because you had a lot of disappointments too.
There are a lot of disappointments. Maybe just as many, maybe the disappointments are easier to describe because they're more concrete than the joys, because the joy is just, I went on stage, I loved it. Whether you're 7 or you're 37, it's the same joy. It's kind of boring to write down. But the disappointments, those are really specific. The point shoes that you wanted, the role, the injury, all of that.
Yeah. I love that idea that the joys are kind of more general.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's basically the same. I warmed up, I went on stage, I danced real good, I loved it. That's it, you know.
Now, you do a couple times in the book, you mention like your memories of having danced a perfect move of some sort. So they must have been really difficult moves that you didn't always get just perfect. And then, but you, because you remember the time that you did get it perfect.
Right. Some of them are difficult and some of them are just that perfect harmony of just enough force to do this small thing, a perfect storm of feeling calm and feeling grounded and still executing something that makes you feel like you fly. That's that doesn't happen very often. Or maybe it does, but you need to have these specific moments, or I needed to have these specific moments that I remembered over and over again, to make them more concrete than a move that you take for granted because you're a dancer. And so, of course, you do pirouettes. Or of course, you jump off the ground.
Now, you mentioned that you're also the wife of a dancer, and men have a little bit of an easier time. Their careers can last longer.
They do. And then I started dancing when I was about 7, and my husband started in college when he was in his 20s. And it is very, men are always in demand, especially ones who are nice to work with and remember the choreography, things that are, of course you have to do that as a dancer if you're female dancer. But again, men have, it's very interesting because there's so many women in ballet, we have a lot to dance. If you're in Swan Lake, you're a swan. You do a lot of dancing as a swan. And if you're a dude, you're one of the prince's friends and you walk around. So it's a longer career, but you don't get to do as many interesting things.
And one of your husband's real skills and what made him a great career was his ability to partner the ballerinas.
Right.
You want to talk about that a little bit and how you, like, is that how you got together? He was partnering you or did that come after you got together?
That came later. We met at a wedding of other dancers, a wedding that I was not invited to, but showed up anyway, because I thought I should be invited, and I showed up anyway. And we were at the singles table, and we met in that way. And yes, my husband Matt is a really good partner, and he doesn't have a lot of ego into himself being seen as he's dancing. I think that started because he started so late. But for him, it wasn't so much the performing aspect as much as it was the puzzle of working out in real time the pas de deux, this partnering. And what he often did was he was kind of like the ringer for many of these ballet schools, and he taught many partnering classes and rehearsed many dancers. So young dancers who aren't used to being partnered, and he would teach them how to hold themselves so that it's easier to lift them, how to coordinate, that because it's two people working at the same time, and the less experienced you are, then, you know, you just don't have as much information as to how to be in time and space so a partner can lift you and turn you and do all those complicated things. So he enjoyed it kind of like as a puzzle, like how do we get to this common space of these five whip turns or this overhead lift? And he was good at that because he would listen to his partner. He would meet, and often they were girls who hadn't had a young woman who hadn't had partnering before. So he was also able to put them at ease about what they were doing. A lot of times they were self-conscious about just being in close proximity to a dude who's lifting you.
Yeah. I mean, they have to be touching you in ways that you're not normally being touched.
Right. Right. And also convey a sense that we're doing something in a common way, you know, we're in a mutual way to create this move. There isn't any kind of rapport here that often happens with hugging or touching or whatever. So he was really good at creating that space for them and making them feel like, oh, okay, we're just doing a move. This is just a grand jeté. This is just a pirouette. And there's a lot of mechanics that I can work on, that he's working on, that we're working on together to make these turns happen.
Right.
Yeah. So he's really good at his job.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Janine Kovac, author of The Nutcracker Chronicles. So you started dancing when you were about 7, and you started performing in the Nutcracker when you were about 12, and that went on for, like, were you in the Nutcracker every holiday season for years?
Yep, pretty much until I moved to Europe. Even after I moved to Europe and danced in Europe, I would often come home around November, December, and dance in El Paso's Nutcracker. Because Nutcracker is not a big thing in where I was dancing in Italy and in Iceland. And we just had a winter break. So I would come home and dance in the Nutcracker. Yeah, many, many years, probably about 20 years.
So El Paso seems like an odd place to, it's a surprising place to me to have a professional dance ballet.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. How did that happen? That happened because there was a woman named Ingeborg Häuser, and she was German. She grew up in Berlin and danced in the Deutsche Berlin Oper, which is their opera, theater, ballet company, all under one umbrella. She was a theater child, so that meant that she was very young and dancing in these operas and ballets when it was required. And then World War II happened. And if you were in Berlin in World War II, we know how that story ends. So she got out and made her way to the United States. I don't know how she ended up in El Paso. I heard the rumor that she married a U.S. serviceman. El Paso has a very big military presence, big military base here. And that was the story that got handed down to me. But I actually don't know. I actually don't know. But once she was here, she taught what she knew, which was ballet. And because she had grown up so close to how ballets were made, cost from the ground up, so the costumes that one would need, the shoes, the music, how to put that all together. She knew what that entailed. And she also copied her school after what they do in Europe, which is you are housed in a building that has all its resources. So she became a university professor. She created the ballet program at what is now University of Texas at El Paso. And in the fine arts department, she had access to everything. She had a place to store costumes, a place to store scenery, students who would build the scenery, or at least space for professionals to come in and build the scenery. She had access to an orchestra. It was really brilliant. At the time, she had a structure, like a physical structure to support the ballet company that San Francisco Ballet didn't even have.
Wow.
Because it's just not how American ballets organically grew up, but she knew what she needed, and so she put it all together.
So the ballet company wasn't technically part of the university, but it had all the resources of the university.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Interesting.
And then she did teach at the university, so you could take her class and then be in the Nutcracker and earn some college credit, and the students in the music department would learn the music for the Nutcracker and play for our performances, and which is also really unusual to have a small regional company with a live orchestra. That's really unusual. But she copied it after her own upbringing, and she also, which was another thing that was interesting, in Berlin she had a mentor who was a woman. She had female mentors, choreographers, teachers, and I think that's significant because nobody bossed her around. You know, she decided what was going to happen, and people were like, oh, I guess we need to build a ballet studio with this kind of floor.
Talk about the floor, because there's a couple references to it in the book about but I don't really know what they mean.
Oh, yeah. You can't just dance on anything. You have to dance on a specific kind of floor. And that floor needs to have a certain kind of, we call it Marley, which I think is the brand, but like a covering that can be rolled up and you can take it someplace else. The floor itself is often raised. We had something called a sprung floor. So the floor, it was built into, it's not really on springs because that would be disastrous. That would be bouncy, and you don't want bouncy. You just want something that has enough give that it absorbs some of the momentum that as you're jumping down, it needs to absorb some of that. So that's what the floor is. It's not a hardwood floor like the movies. Like, you can't dance on a hardwood floor.
Is it a permanent floor, or is it something that you can take to different theaters when you're on tour, or both?
Really good question. Yes, both. Nowadays, companies and schools will have their own floor. That's pallets that they can disassemble and reassemble in a new space. And then the Marley covering is in like 3.5 by however long strips that are then taped down on the floor. You have to make sure that there are no bubbles, that it's smooth, that it's straight, that the tape is smooth. It's not going to catch on someone's toe when they're dancing. And when I started dancing, you just went to the theater and you you get what you get and you don't get upset. And sometimes the floors would be really hard because people just nailed hardwood slabs onto a surface, but you would jump on it anyway. Often we would have the Marley covering because it's very dangerous to have a hardwood floor that has nails in it, that has strips, that might have parts of wood that aren't kind of flush. So we always had a Marley covering over the almost always. But nowadays, companies and schools will have their own pallets that they carry with them. Wow. It's a big deal. It's a big deal to have. And then the other thing is, in Europe, the stages are raked. That means they're slanted. So if you think about when you go to a movie theater or something, there's like, or a, you go watch a baseball game or whatever, the stadiums and the theaters are slanted. So the rows behind you are a little bit higher so you can see what's going on stage. That seems kind of obvious.
Right.
But when they were building these theaters in Europe, it didn't feel so obvious. So they made the stage slanted.
Oh my gosh.
And
the audience
is flat.
Oh, wow.
So you dance on a slanted stage. It's not super slanted, but it's slanted enough that you can feel it.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, if you put a marble, it's going to roll into the orchestra pit.
Whoa. That must take some getting used to.
That takes some getting used
to. Boy.
That's not fun.
I guess.
Wow.
And then, of course, the bigger the theater, the bigger the stage, the bigger the slant.
Wow.
They call it a raked stage.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Janine Kovac, author of The Nutcracker Chronicles. Janine, you talked about this German teacher in El Paso, Ms. Heuser. Would you consider her a mentor or a nemesis?
Because we have the story of the Nutcracker that is the narrative art for my memoir, she's kind of the Drosselmeyer role. And Drosselmeyer is the godfather who gifts Clara the Nutcracker, but he's also the weirdo who makes the magic happen. So she's kind of the Drosselmeyer character. She is both a mentor and a nemesis. Creatively, she was absolutely a mentor. She was the first woman that I had seen in a position of power like that, or maybe authority is a better word than power, as the director and resident choreographer. And she led by example. She was strict as you might imagine.
And kind of mean.
Yeah, she was spiteful.
And it seems like that maybe was common among directors of ballet companies.
Yes.
So I have a very brief ballet story. I, like you, as a little girl, had the little music box with the ballerina on top that went around, and I really wanted to learn, you know, to take ballet lessons, but wasn't able to when I was little. And then when I was in seventh, and my little sister wanted to take ballet, and at that point the family was more able to do that, and so they said, well, that I could take ballet too. Well, you know, at the time it was kind of embarrassing because everybody else beginning ballet was, you know, 7 years old and I was 12. So it wasn't really my thing anymore. but we went to this ballet teacher in the town down the road. I think the town was named Burdenhand, Pennsylvania. And she was this little French woman named Miss Claire. And she had the studio in her basement. And that was where we learned ballet. And the thing that I remember most from it was that she was always telling, I was very skinny and very bony, and she was always telling me to round my elbows. But there was no way to do it. They stuck out no matter what I did. My elbows were going to stick out. So later on, I was running track and I fell on a cinder track and I got a pretty bad scar on my elbow. And as an adult, I would tell my nieces that that I got that from trying to sand off my elbows so that I could because of my ballet teacher. And they would believe me, but then I'd have to tell them it was just a joke. But yeah. So, you know, it was interesting because for a lot, you know, you talk a lot about she would make fun of people for not being skinny enough. Mm-hmm. But I always felt like I was too skinny to be a ballerina. And I don't know if that's even possible.
Well, I think it is part of your training is figuring out how to be coordinated, right? Mm. And sometimes if you're long and lanky, it's hard to figure that out, you know, and especially yes. if you're 12 years old and your body is planning for other things that are going to happen to it. And there's a lot going on in there in terms of coordination
yeah.
and being grounded, yourself out. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And my younger sister ended up staying in dance through high school and becoming very, you know, she never tried to go be professional or anything, but she was a very good dancer. And I had one semester of beginning ballet and that was it.
That was it.
Yeah. How about you, Mom? Did you ever take dance classes when you were young?
Well, I don't think so. Well, maybe I did. I can't remember. I don't know.
That was a long time ago.
Well, see, I played piano from the time I was 5 years old. So I was playing piano in recitals. I wasn't, you know, into dance.
Yeah.
But you're dancing with your fingers.
Yeah.
You said the dancer should not look at their feet while dancing. It breaks the aesthetic line and it also breaks the focus. But how can you not? I mean, I think that, I don't know, that sounded strange, but I'm sure you know what you're doing. I mean, but is that really?
Well, you mean in terms of, did you think that you're thinking maybe we should be looking at our feet to see what they're doing? Or
Well, I don't know. I don't know because I was never a dancer. So I don't know.
Well, you know, I'd like to think that our brain extends into our fingertips and our toes. And that kind of makes sense to me because those are nerve endings, right? And that's just basically what your brain is, a bunch of nerve beginnings. So it just makes sense that the nerve endings are an extension of your brain. And I think that's kind of how dancers feel themselves in space. So the fancy word for it is proprioception, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the I think that's what we, as teachers, we don't realize we're teaching that because we say this is a glissade and this is a plié and point your toes and round your elbows, but we're really certainly demonstrating how to be a body moving in space. And the more you do that, it's kind of like having, you know, moms who have eyes in the back of their head and you can feel what's behind you. You can feel what's around you. You can feel where the dancers are. Certainly that's a talent or a skill that you're going to hone when you're partnering, to feel where your partner is and how to work together. So and that's its own kind of focus. So if I break that focus to look at my feet, I actually can't move my feet by looking at them, right? I move my feet by feeling them move in space or telling them to move in space, but not by looking at them. So if I break my focus and look at my feet, I'm getting out of that space where I feel everything around me. And then once you've broken that concentration, you're out of the moment, you're out of the music, you're out of the step. If you're performing, then now that voice comes in like, oh my gosh, what do I need to do next? And you just kind of, you might blank out. That would be a worst case scenario. Mm-hmm.
So okay. Yeah, Caroline, compare it kind of to playing piano.
Yeah.
When you know the piece, you're not looking at your fingers when you play.
Right. And you're certainly not looking at, like, I think when I'm playing piano, I'm looking at this one key and I know that is C and I'm recognizing, okay, that's C because it's white and it's got the little black key up here. And that's so past what you're thinking when you're fluent, right? So it would be the equivalent of like looking at your finger and saying, okay, I'm playing a C note. Wait, is that a C note? Yes, that's the C note.
Well, it's interesting how, you know, you watch the music and then your fingers are knowing where the keys are. Once in a while you hit a wrong note because, you know, that happens. But, yeah, music is interesting. in many ways. Yeah, music and dance.
Right, because your fingers really are dancing, right? There's a muscle memory there. They know where to go. You're not thinking about moving the pinky finger. At a certain point, you're not thinking of moving your pinky finger and your thumb and matching it up with this note or that note. There's a muscle memory mm-hmm. in the hands working with your ear that just go and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, Janine, what are some facts about the Nutcracker that readers may not know?
Oh, I could go on and on and on. So, the Nutcracker Ballet was based on a short story adaptation by Alexandre Dumas, the guy who wrote The Three Musketeers.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't write The Nutcracker and the Mouse King. He adapted it from E.T.A. Hoffman's short story. And E.T.A. Hoffman was a very prolific short story writer, and he wrote music, and he's Prussian, so he's in, you know, what we now think of as Germany, and often worked in what we now call Munich and Bavaria. In his real life, he was a judge, and he was kind of grumpy. He couldn't be bribed, so a lot of people didn't like him, and that made him even grumpier. And he had to depend on nice patrons to make sure that he could have money to write his short stories and things like that. And I'm obviously oversimplifying. But one of his patrons, he was the godfather to this patron's, his children, their children. And those children were named Marie and Fritz. And E.T.A. Hoffman had some opinions about how Marie and Fritz were being raised. And so he wrote this short story called The Nutcracker and the Mouse King. And in it, there's a godfather. Godfather's name is Drosselmeyer, who's this weird guy who comes on New Year's, not New Year's Eve, but Christmas Eve, and brings these toys to Marie and Fritz. And there's a fairy tale nested inside a fairy tale. And that was the impetus for this short story, for E.T.A. Hoffman to kind of say, you need to let your kids be more creative. You're too structured as a parent. You need to be to listen to them when they talk and create stories. So that was his idea behind writing this story. And it has some dark moments. And then it got adapted into the ballet. And like the same way that you take your favorite book and it becomes a movie and it loses all your favorite parts, that's kind of what happened to the Nutcracker Ballet. So it doesn't bear a lot in resemblance to the story, aside from the fact that there's a nutcracker and it comes to life. And
so
there's Clara, and she gets it.
Clara or Marie, why'd the name change?
Right. So that's one of those things that happens when you adapt a book into a movie or a ballet, and you have to think that these things are bureaucratic, right? There's somebody at the top in St. Petersburg who says, listen, Tchaikovsky, we need you to do an opera and we need you to do a ballet. And there's some guys in a room and they're looking at the story and they're saying, okay, we could use this part, but not this part. And someone else says, yeah, but I like that part. And there's so these decisions happening at the top that aren't necessarily creative decisions.
Mm.
There might be somebody saying, well, we really need to use this dancer. We really need to make sure that we do X and Y to please this person and that person. The very first Nutcracker performance was part of a double bill. And the first 3 hours were an opera. It's about a blind princess stuck in a cave, and her father doesn't want her to realize that she's blind, so she's in a cave. And then the second half of the evening was the Nutcracker.
Oh my gosh, that was a long evening.
Really long evening. So that might have had some people think that might have had some certainly influenced audiences. It had an effect on how audiences felt about the evening. But it might have also affected how Tchaikovsky adapted the music to make it a little bit lighter or fluffier. The short story is very dark.
Mm.
Clara falls and she's all cut up and her and when the Nutcracker comes to life, you know, bad things happen, and then the revenge fairy tale is kind of dark because all the mice children get killed.
Oh my.
And
right. Now in the ballet you have the second act where you've got all these different ethnic characters mm-hmm. doing
right.
ethnic dances of
right.
some sort. How did that wasn't part of the original story?
That is not part of the original story. In the original story, the Nutcracker comes to Clara in her dreams, and he's like, well, when you're old enough, I'll come back and we can get married. And she's like, that sounds awesome. Because she's only seven. And so if you don't know the second act of the Nutcracker, Clara and the prince go to the land of the sweets. There's a sugar plum fairy. It's not clear her jurisdiction, but there is a Spanish variation, chocolate from Spanish, tea from China, and coffee from Arabia. There's marzipan, sometimes called merlotons, mother ginger, so it's supposed to be ginger cookies. And it was kind of a thing in romantic ballets at the time to have dances that were imagined as coming from someplace else. So in Swan Lake, there's a party, and it's always there's a party or there's a wedding, so we can have an excuse for these different short dances, which is also a need to use all these dancers. You know, St. Petersburg has 70 dancers. You have one swan, one prince, 30 swans, and what do you do with the rest of them? Well, they dance in the Spanish dance. They dance in what we think of as Chinese. For Arabian, Tchaikovsky took an old Georgian lullaby. Georgia, the country that's very much south and not part of Russia at the time, of course, but very much part of a place where Russian aristocracy would go to vacation, or people had summer houses there. And of course, the Georgians had their own country and customs. And he adapted a common lullaby and turned it into the motif for the Arabian variation. But you're right, there's nothing like that in the short story. And so as it's evolved, sometimes these variations become, particularly the Chinese variation, right? That's a caricature of what people imagine, either at the time imagined was Chinese or Orientalism. A lot of that has started in the as people started to create their own versions, that other choreographers now are wondering, wait a minute, how do we do this in a responsible way? This music doesn't sound Spanish. This music doesn't sound Chinese. And even if it did, why would we? What's going on here? How do we be traditional and still feel? Tasteful, respectful.
Yeah. Not be.
Culturally appropriating in this kind of silly and icky way,
or stereotyping, not
right, exactly,
furthering stereotypes,
exactly.
Well, Jeanine, why don't you read a little bit from the Nutcracker Chronicles before we run out of time?
All right, I will do that. And I will read as requested. I will read from the middle of the book, and
Page 97.
Page 97. And so
87.
And what you know here is that at this point, I'm a professional dancer and living in San Francisco with a company that doesn't have a Nutcracker. Instead, we danced the Christmas ballet. The first act was costumed in white and choreographed to classical music. The second act was all red and set to popular Christmas songs like Bing Crosby's White Christmas and Eartha Kitt's Santa Baby. There were tap dancing trees and even an Elvis impersonator. One of my roles was the little surfer girl in Leon Redbone's Christmas Island. My job was to sit on the shoulders of my partner as he stood on a surfboard mounted on a platform. One day in rehearsal, the director decided to try something new. What if I stood on my partner's shoulders instead? Could I do that? In ballet companies, if you want to get ahead or just keep your part, the answer is always yes. My partner has money stripped off his shirt to minimize slippage, and I removed my shoes and rolled up my tights over my calves, bare skin on bare skin. That seemed safest. Try it without the platform, the director suggested. Asmani, take her by the waist and lift her onto your shoulders. And now from there, take her hands. Can you climb on his shoulders from there? I couldn't. Sitting on Asmani's shoulders the way you might play chicken in a swimming pool didn't give me enough leverage to stand. Okay. Climb up from behind. See if that works. Asmani crouched down and reached his arms over his head to grab my hands. I tried to climb on his back as if he were a boulder, but it didn't work. So I tried again, hoisting up one leg, planting it a foot directly on his shoulder, and then using the momentum to plant my weight and swing the other leg up. With shaky but strong legs, Asmani stood. I could feel him find his balance, which helped me find my own. I straightened my legs. This isn't so hard, I thought. That looks great, the director grinned. Let's try it on the board. Asmani climbed onto the surfboard platform and extended a hand. I stood behind him and we clasped hands. Shouldn't someone spot her? My friend Amy asked. The director shook his head. She's got this, he said with confidence. I've got this, I repeated to myself. I swung one foot, then the other onto Asmani's shoulders. Beads of perspiration dotted his skin. Don't look down, I thought, as I did exactly that. I could feel my center of gravity tilt when I did. It made Asmani wobble, which he used to help him wiggle back into a steady stance. His stability became my foundation. Standing tall in my black leotard and tights, I towered over the studio full of dancers, their concentration mirroring mine. I looked straight ahead, pressing down through my feet and pressing my palms into Asmani's. A solid balance feels like a moving current. It's electric. Asmani bent his elbows as I bent my knees and prepared to dismount. Our hands were sticky. A dancer should never look at her feet while she's dancing. It breaks the aesthetic line. It also breaks her focus. The shift of balance was minuscule. A waver, a flicker, like an absent-minded thought. If I had been able to teeter forward, then back, we might have found our balance again. But when I glanced at my toes, sliding off Asmani's chest, now slick with sweat, I had a flash of panic. My colleagues looked up at me as I started to fall, all of them too far away to help. My mind flipped through the various possible scenarios. I pictured Asmani twisting on the narrow surface of the platform, contorting to catch me, his back breaking on the edge as we both toppled. I imagined him shifting to keep his balance, but falling on one foot, knee cracking as we both crashed to the floor. I envisioned myself falling forward, puncturing my sternum on the edge of the board. I saw myself falling into his arms, helpless like a fish flopping on the shore, taking him down with me. As soon as you imagine that you are falling, you fall. If only I had the courage to say, I'm not sure what I'm doing. If only I'd been able to find the eye of the storm within my balance. If only we'd had someone spotting us. If only I hadn't imagined falling. I pushed off Asmani's chest with my feet as if it were a diving board, and he thrust my feet forward on a diagonal, propelling me past the edge of the board. They say I flew. I soared through the air like an acrobat. I landed on my face in a collapsed push-up. My legs bent back over my head. I never braced for impact. If there were gasps or shrieks, I didn't hear them. Someone helped me to my feet. Someone else gave me some water to drink. Are you okay? Are you hurt? Do you want to see a doctor? Do you need anything? Do you think you can dance tonight? I answered yes to all the questions. In the waiting room of the ER, Amy filled out the forms for me. She described the accident. Fell from a height of 12 feet onto her face. A nurse checked for broken teeth. A doctor examined me for internal bleeding. The x-ray technician looked for broken bones. Nothing. Tell me again how you fell? The doctor looked at me, puzzled. After I described the accident, he shook his head. You could have bitten your tongue or smashed your rib cage. I couldn't tell if he thought it was miraculous or if he thought I was exaggerating. Yeah, sure, you can dance tonight. Come back if anything changes. I'll stop there.
Wow.
That was amazing. It really was.
So you danced that night.
I danced that night. And the night after that, and the night after that.
But you did have some lasting effects from the fall.
Yes, I did. Technically, what happened is I strained my psoas, which is like the filet mignon of your muscles, your internal kind of abdomens. And it attaches at the ribs and it attaches kind of at your hips. And so that was really unstable. And so if it went into spasm, I wouldn't be able to walk or stand up.
Oh, wow.
So some structural things that happened. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So you went from being a dancer to being a writer.
Yes,
what did you bring from your dancing life that helped you in your writing life?
Well, definitely the discipline. You write even when you don't feel like writing, you just write. It helped me to ignore all those voices or to contextualize the feedback that I got. So we talked a little bit about those directors who are very mean and they say these things. And at some point, especially when you're little trying to figure this out, you realize they don't really mean it. They're trying to be funny or they're trying to motivate you or they're trying to be mean, but it's not you. And so all those criticisms go through a filter. So as a writer, all the feedback that I get, it certainly isn't as mean as what you get from directors. But it does need to be contextualized. And sometimes people don't know what your writing needs, but they know what's wrong with it. So, and the same thing that happens with dance, someone will say, your elbows need to be rounded. But what they really mean is, I'm just extrapolating from my own dance students, they might mean, I need to see you flow through your arms, or you look like you're holding yourself. You need to like flow through, something like that. So I took that from the dancing, just how to respond to feedback. And then the other thing that I took was, as a dancer, I did, I don't know, 10 to 15 auditions a year, easily, looking for a company that would be a right fit. And right fit means something that's fun to dance, enough money to make it my day job, a city that's going to support the arts. So I was always looking to have a good option. And so I learned that a lot of times rejection isn't personal. It doesn't have anything to do. Sometimes it's just they're not looking for dancers today, or they're not looking for dancers with dark hair, or they just whatever it is. And I take that with me to my writing, because there's so many rejections in writing, and it's not personal.
Dancers make it look so easy, and I know it's not easy.
That's our job.
But yeah, I know. But it is a pleasure to watch, and I've always admired people who could dance ballet. So.
Well, what made you decide you wanted to write?
I have been writing longer than I have been dancing. So as soon as I could read, I started writing books and stapling them together and selling them to my parents for a quarter. And so I have always written, but I didn't know, what I didn't know was how to make the link from someone who writes a lot to someone who is a writer. And when my twins were born, that's something else that happens over the, the course of the book. I become a mother. I have twins. They're born several months premature. And so they're in the hospital for 3 months. And it was in that moment that I realized I have to figure out how to be a writer. It's not enough anymore to just write. And so I decided to use my dance career as a template for how to be a writer in the world. Because there are a lot of people who dance. You described, you know, people, you take class when you're little, and then you go to college and maybe you take some classes, but you don't know how to make the leap between dancing in the studio to this is my day job. So I found a community of writers. I volunteered for literary festivals. I went to see where are these writers and what are they doing and how can I copy? I found writers who were better than I was and read writers who were better than I was. That's something else you do. You find people who are better than you are and try to hang around them. And realized, I put my work out there. I revise it when it's not what I wanted to say. And I just keep doing that. That's basically all you do.
So what about this award for distinguished research in cognitive science? What were you researching?
It was cognitive. I was researching words, actually. So in between dancing and deciding to be a writer, I went to college when I was 35 to learn cognitive science, went to Berkeley, and I studied cognitive science. And cognitive linguistics was my concentration. And my thesis looked at parenting books and the language in the parenting books where everybody's an expert if you're going to have a published parenting book, and they say the opposite things. One says you need to pick up your kid. One says you need to let your kid cry. And I figured that I could analyze the deep structural metaphors behind the passages and figure this out.
Well, that sounds like a topic for a whole other interview.
That is.
But we're out of time.
Yes, it does.
Caroline, do you have a closing quote for us today?
Well, the beauty of ballet is the pleasure of dancing, and it happens in the present, and it pleases many people who watch.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you for having me.